Good afternoon and welcome to the Independent News Hour. I'm John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent, New York City's lefty newspaper and website. I'm joined today by the Indy's associate editor, Amma Gagarian.
Hi, John. It's great to be here with you and all our listeners on 99.5 FM and streaming on WBAI.org.
We have some exciting news to share. Earlier today, we hit the streets of New York City with our April print edition.
You can find the new issue of The Indy in our red and white news boxes on a street corner near you in more than 60 public libraries, as well as in independent bookstores, cafes, social movement centers, even laundromats, and other venues around the city.
And Amma wrote a deeply reported cover story on the resurgent labor movement and some of its campaigns here in New York City that we'll talk about in a little bit.
Thanks. You can also find all the articles online at independent.org. Well, especially tomorrow. As of tomorrow, you'll be able to find all the articles. Some of them are online today. But there's an absolutely stunning center spread photo essay by indie photographers who've been covering pro-Palestine protests for months that you will want to get your hands on in person to put on your refrigerator, on a wall, or on a wall at home.
In the first half of today's Independent News Hour, we'll be speaking with two writers, again, Amma Gagarian, and also Ariana Orozco, about their stories in our newly released April edition of The Independent. Amma's cover story looks at how younger workers are leading the charge in a resurgent labor movement as they strive to turn low-wage retail and service sector jobs into stable, good-paying union jobs, and they are winning victories once thought impossible.
We'll also hear from India reporter Ariana Orozco. She has been covering the state of New York's attempt to close SUNY Downstate Hospital in central Brooklyn. Ariana also spoke with medical students at Albert Einstein College of Medicine about the recent announcement that a $1 billion donation to the school would ensure students at the school would not have to pay tuition.
So, Amma, let's start with you and your cover story. Labor on the Move, a new wave of union organizing keeps spreading and winning. That's the headline on page one, on the front page of The Independent. For starters, can you tell us about the variety of campaigns you reported on and why these younger workers are so eager to unionize their workplaces?
Yes, John, absolutely. I love to see you wrestling around the new issue of The Independent. Maybe some of our listeners heard the paper in the background. It's beautiful. We have a great color illo by Tyrone Wallace. Different fights, really showing up to act in solidarity against their bosses, which is what this piece is about specifically the labor movement, the resurgent labor movement, you know, that we've seen rising since really the outbreak of COVID in 2020, you know, and all these workers responding to that, and whether it be forming independent unions, independent new unions that they're running, or joining already formed unions. And then within the already formed, you know, big established unions, we've also seen this like wave of democratic militarized, militarized. Oh, gosh. No, and it's not what I'm saying. He's dabbing right now. I'm saying militant, but nearly guerrilla sort of union organizing within these established unions, right? And so that's what I'm saying when I mean upsurge. I was looking at that in New York City, how the young labor movement is really maintaining momentum in New York City, from Starbucks workers to obviously the Amazon workers unionizing, but we also have Trader Joe's workers. We have Barnes & Noble now that's rapidly unionizing. We have REI workers that have unionized. Greenlight Bookstore over in Park Slope is unionized. Now Nighthawk Cinemas have unionized. Nighthawk Cinema over in, also in Park Slope, Prospect Park unionized just within the past few days in a 51-41 election. That's like 90% of the workforce. Huge turnout. So people are feeling it. We have Alamo Draft House, you know, we have new Starbucks unionizing. The list goes on. The momentum is there. That's what I found.
Right. So for starters, just to give a sense of what's going on here, let's talk about the most recent group of a recent group of workers you covered who won a union election, the workers at Nighthawk Cinema. What ignited their desire to unionize last summer when some big movie blockbusters were playing at their theater? And also, what were the obstacles they had to overcome? And what was it like to be there a couple of weeks ago at the moment when they won their election.
Right. So they unionized after the Barbie Oppenheimer, known as Barbie Heimer, big double debut, right? Some are arguing trying to bring back sort of this idea of Americans going to the cinema. And that's great. But the workers, you know, had to pay the price. Extremely busy, high demand. They're working in, as you may have known if you've gone to Nighthawk or these other dine-in cinemas, they're crouching down. They're wearing earpieces. The kitchen is huge. They're serving all these different theaters, running around, communicating with each other in that way. And the working conditions aren't great. There's that. You know, I could go on about the working conditions and how it's difficult, but also they were feeling this movement of other young people organizing, taking back their rights in the workplace and saying, we actually are a big part of how our boss is able to make profit. And so we can and, you know, have a say and we want to exercise that right. So it was also part of the movement. But absolutely, you know, responding to working conditions.
Yeah. Well. And one of the organizers that assisted them had participated in a union campaign at Barbertino
Pizza. Yeah, so they reached out to Barbertino's, which is the first standalone pizzeria in New York City to unionize in June of 2021, I believe.
I think it was last year.
Last year, sorry. June of last year. I got all of these.
It's been a blur.
I know. All of these different campaigns mixed up. June of last year, they unionized. And one of the workers who was a part of that project, who was not, you know, he was not a salt, he was not a plant, he was just a Barbertino worker who realized, you know, that they needed to unionize their, I think their ceiling crashed in, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back. They reached out, the Nighthawk workers found out about that, had heard about that campaign because it was pretty public within the labor world, and they emailed the Barbertino's email, and so these two, you know, service, you know, jobs, or these two restaurants that were owned by local New York businesses, it's not just the corporates that are being unionized, you know, it's anybody, and some of these local businesses do run their, run the show in as corporate of a way as possible, I'll say. So they got together, and the organizer from Barbertino's, Alex, is also a volunteer with the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee here in New York, which is a project that helps organize a lot of different workers in different ways. And he supported that action, and then it just, you know, snowballed, and they created their organizing committee, core group of organizers, and had a pretty quick campaign over the course of just about 7-8 months, and were able to win with a high turnout. I know turnout from the boss was something he was pushing for as a part of his union busting campaign, where he did all of the sort of regular union busting things, threatening workers, spreading rumors, and firing workers.
Right. Now, so, I mean, one thing your article explores is, I mean, there's sort of, in terms of the organizing terrain in the service industries here in New York, I mean, you have sort of these more sort of artisanal, sort of independently owned successful businesses like Nighthawk or Barbertino Pizza, who can only muster so much resources when confronted with a union campaign. And then we have the bigger corporate chains like Amazon or Starbucks or Trader Joe's that have nearly unlimited resources in terms of the union-busting law firms and all the rest that they can mobilize on their behalf. Yet at Starbucks, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. There was a huge breakthrough recently, after a couple of years of scorched earth union busting activity. The company announced it would restore benefits it had denied to unionized stores, and it would enter into collective bargaining with the more than 400 stores that are currently unionized at Starbucks. So, I mean, that's seen as a potentially huge breakthrough, not only for the Starbucks campaign, but for other sort of corporate employers who are facing union drives. So you spoke with workers at a couple of different Starbucks stores, one store that had sort of been through union busting hell out on Long Island, and another that recently filed for an election that's going to happen later this week.
Right, absolutely. That's the Starbucks in 4th Ave and 11th Street in Park Slope. And they're confident in their campaign that we're going to win. So we'll be watching on the 28th for that. That's on Thursday. So But in regards to the news more generally with Starbucks and the company, you know, saying that it's going to bargain in good faith and also give raises and benefits to the unionized stores, which it's been withholding.
And that's been a real drag on the unionization effort.
Yeah, it's hard to get people to want to join your union when they're like, well, I might not get my raise, you know. So, right, that's totally illegal. That's illegal union busting behavior tactics. And the Starbucks win, I think, because the workers have faced all of that. A lot of them were, not going to lie, sort of skeptical, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, Starbucks has said so many things, and they've done X and Y, and, well, we think that they definitely didn't do it because they care about us. They've done it because, you know, they've faced, like, $11 billion loss in their value, you know, since November due to the union speaking out, you know, speaking out for Gaza, speaking out for Palestine, and then the company, you know, reacting very strongly against that, and therefore lots of boycotts happening around the world. So people were sort of blaming that, and then also just saying, you know, eye rolling, but there was still this just like deep satisfaction and excitement that permeates everything, because at the end of the day, they're all exciting. They said, this is what we've been asking for from the beginning, is just to come to the table and negotiate. And I think everybody knows that your union fight is really the largest hurdle to pass, I can say, is getting that first contract.
Absolutely.
So if they can get this, now it feels within their grasp. You know, there's a lot of excitement there, regardless of the intentions of the terrible corporation.
Right. I mean, Starbucks had spent over $240 million on the Littler Mendelson union busting law firm. That's a lot of money to, you know, to not accomplish very much. And there was a shareholder revolt where some pro-union people might have been placed on the board. So, yeah, there was a lot of factors. And then, yes, that boycott, that Starbucks tried to smack down the union for expressing support for the Palestinians back at the beginning of the war, and inadvertently triggered a backlash, especially across the Middle East and North Africa, where, you know, it's a global corporation, and they kind of forgot about that, and they paid the price. And with so many people started boycotting Starbucks as a way to show support for the union and its position of international solidarity with the Palestinian people. Well, just one more thing on this topic. What did you find to be most inspiring about covering this story?
Well, I think, you know, it's great to see that, yeah, these workers are going against these up against these corporations, where the lawyers and the union busting advisors are making, you know, like high hundreds. I mean, I remember I was covering, you know, Amazon union busting at one point, and they were paying like $3,000 an hour to some of these lawyers. And then you have these people who are making, you know, anywhere between $15 and $25 an hour, spending all of their extra time and any time they can find at work to organize their coworkers, to get some of the goods that they so well deserve. But it's also just people showing their power against, you know, the elites. And that might sound sort of polemic, but it's really heartening to see my generation do that, because there's not a lot of hope on the horizon regarding the economy and many other factors for us.
Right. And one of the workers, I think Brendan Lopez from Farmingville, Long Island, you spoke to, I mean, one of the things I recall him emphasizing that kind of kept him engaged was the feeling of community that had grown up around this effort.
Right, of course. Going into more detail, you end up spending all your extra time with these people, the people you're organizing with. You get together to meet and talk about your plans, develop your plans, but you also build really close friendships with people who have really similar interests. So people are building communities that exist beyond work and beyond, you know, their phones and the superficiality of some other relationships, and they're building, like, really, I think I'm seeing, you know, trustworthy friendships. And that's something that is also priceless.
Right. I mean, when you go on like a Twitter, you know, you go on social media and you see the photos of whether it's Starbucks workers or the Nighthawk workers or whoever after they've won an election, and you just see the smiles like across their faces. And
yeah, you can tell they know each other too, yeah, in the photos. You know what I mean? The way that they're hugging. So yeah, it's great. You know, it's really good to see.
Right. Now, also, just to before we wrap up this segment, the unionizing efforts that you cover in your article, and there's a lot more you have to say in your article, so people should definitely get their hands on this issue or
absolutely.
Or go to independent.org tomorrow when we have all the articles up. So there's a lot more to AMBA's reporting. That's just, we're just sort of skimming the surface there. But also, there's even more happening. I mean, right now, the United Auto Workers, coming off its big victory last fall, I mean, they're making a historic push in the South. There's going to be a union election at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee on April 17th and 18th. That would potentially be the first non-union auto factory in the South to unionize. The stodgy, stale version of the UAW tried to unionize that factory a couple of times about a decade ago and failed. This time they're really, the union's taking much more of a worker-centered approach to the organizing, so it looks promising. There's also auto factories in Alabama, a Mercedes factory, a Hyundai factory in Montgomery, Alabama, where the workers are signing cards at a rapid clip, and they may reach that threshold of calling an election in a matter of weeks, and also in Troy, Missouri, at a Toyota plant. And I also saw something last night that workers at a Waffle House in Conyers, Georgia, walked off the job because the company had instituted this bogus $3 meal deduction, where if you're a worker there at Waffle House, whether you ordered a meal during your break or not, you had to pay the company $3.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, it's great to see these service workers beginning to organize, because that was the sector that was, said to be sort of impossible to organize, and now is one of the largest sectors of the American economy after the deindustrialization of the workforce and the jobs. And so that's the people to unionize, and that's what we're seeing, and really that's what this piece is about.
Yeah.
But speaking of Waffle House.
Right. And there's so much more we could talk about on this topic, but we'll let it go at that. We wish all the best to the Waffle House workers. So we'll be back with more after this short break, when we'll talk with Ariana Orozco about her coverage for the Indy.
That was The World's History by Peter Thomas Sound Orchestra, and you are listening to the Independent News Hour on WBAI 99.5 FM and streaming on WBAI.org. I am Amba Gurgarian, your co-host here with my other host, John Tarleton, and we are going to continue talking about some of the highlights from our April print edition, which hit the streets just today in news boxes and libraries all near you. And we actually have two stories by our new correspondent, Ariana Orozco. You're going to tell us about those, right, John?
That's right. In one article, Ariana looks at the potential closure of SUNY Downstate Hospital in central Brooklyn and the fierce opposition that has stirred. And in her other article, we meet medical school students in the Bronx who recently learned that they would not have to pay any more tuition in their college career thanks to the extraordinary gift that the school received from one of its supporters. Ariana, welcome to WBAI Radio.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you with us. So let's start with SUNY Downstate. Tell us about this hospital, who it serves, and what it would mean for the Central Brooklyn community if it were to close.
Yeah, so SUNY Downstate is located in East Flatbush, and it's attached to the SUNY Downstate Medical Center, and it's really popularly known as, like, the only kidney transplant center in Brooklyn. And it serves a huge portion of Brooklyn's Black, Brown, Medicaid/Medicare, and uninsured patients. So it serves a huge swatch of the population. And over the past 15 years of shutdowns, you know, starting from Brooklyn's Victory Memorial Hospital in 2008 to most recently Kingsbrook Jewish Hospital last fall, SUNY Downstate has really taken on like an increased importance to Brooklyn healthcare. You know, so if it were to close, you know, to be blunt, people would die. There's really no adequate alternative. The next closest hospital, Kings County, is really already bursting at the seams and doesn't have pediatrics or a kidney center. So, you know, best case scenario would be, in the meantime, while they build that infrastructure, there would be children, dialysis patients, and a ton of Brooklynites who would go simply without healthcare.
Wow. Well, talk about the role SUNY Downstate played specifically during the COVID-19 pandemic and how that has contributed to its current problems.
Yeah, so in 2020, then-Governor Cuomo deemed SUNY Downstate a COVID-only hospital. So the hospital was not getting compensated for serving thousands of New Yorkers because it primarily makes its quote-unquote profit, you know, whatever that means for a social service, from Medicare/Medicaid reimbursements. But those reimbursements in New York have remained fairly stagnant. Well, obviously there was a huge need for medical care. So that was really when we saw the most recent kind of deficit that the state is quoting at $100 million, where some correspondents are saying closer to $40 million. But certainly that's where the kind of biggest portion of their, you know, debt, as the state likes to call it, comes from at this current moment.
And who is fighting to save SUNY Downstate now? And what have you been learning from them?
Yeah, so, you know, much like the people that they serve, it's a pretty diverse cohort who's fighting to keep it. So in early March, there was a protest where over 1,000 community members came to really protest. And that was really led by Senator Zelnor Myrie and the United University Professionals. But it also included the New York State United, teachers, and the Public Employees Federation, and a ton of clergy members across the city. So what you're seeing is there's a real desire to keep the hospital open, and a real, you know, that the community is willing to invest in their health care and are only asking that, you know, Governor Hochul does the same.
Right. And so it seems like the fate of the hospital is now tied up in these much larger state budget negotiations that are going on in Albany. Again, SUNY Downstate is under the control of the state, so it's not like the city or city council can intervene here. And for listeners who don't follow the machinations of state government, the end of March is when the annual state budget is due, and it's a $230 billion state budget, and all sorts of stuff gets negotiated into these budget deals, and I guess Senator Myrie and other Brooklyn electeds are trying to make sure that there's provisions in this sprawling budget deal to save the hospital?
Yeah. So there's two really kind of important bills currently that the Senate is trying to pass. So the first is Senator Zelnor Myrie's, and he proposed a similar one last year that passed 62-0, so overwhelming people in favor of a sustainability plan for SUNY Downstate. The other one comes from Senator Gustavo Rivera, who's actually in the Bronx, who wants to increase those Medicare reimbursement rates so that this doesn't just happen to SUNY Downstate, but that we don't see just this consistent pattern of safety net hospitals across the city shutting down, really to the detriment of New York City's low-income, immigrant, Black and Brown populations.
Right. And when these Medicaid reimbursements are shortchanged, I mean, that just means there's more money in the budget pot for maybe other priorities of the governor, like funding new football stadiums or giving out tax breaks to luxury real estate developers. So, I mean, it's a battle here over priorities.
Yeah, certainly. Especially because ultimately, while there are these really two important bills, the budget's going to be passed within kind of the confidence of Governor Hochul and her her selected cabinet, which means that a lot of times these safety net hospitals or their social safety nets get really caught up in kind of a horse trade. So deciding how much people are willing to fight, how much political power people are willing to put behind certain things. And that's what's kind of really frightening about this, is that despite all the efforts of community members, ultimately what it's going to come down to is Governor Hochul.
Right. The governor and then the leadership of the two houses of the state legislature. But yes. I mean, the governor definitely has the strongest hand in these negotiations, which all happen behind closed doors.
Exactly. Yeah.
Deliberately, of course, to sort of keep the rest of the population out of the game. But certainly the union and the Brooklyn elected officials have made their voice heard. Now, moving real quickly to some more hopeful news, which is this development in the Bronx with the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where I think one of the members of the Board of Trustees, I'm sorry I don't have her name on the
Ruth Gottsman.
Ruth Gottsman. Her husband made a ton of money on Wall Street, and she announced she was giving a $1 billion gift to the college so that students would no longer have to pay tuition. You went up there and spoke with the students. What kind of reactions were you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, everyone was overwhelmingly happy, as you can imagine. And I think it's really important also to kind of note, right, that a lot of times people can't go into particular fields or even go to medical school because of the financial burden that it presents. And so one thing I heard from one first-year student, Bailey, who came from a low-income family, was that she feels a lot freer now, right, to be able to pursue the career that she wants to, as opposed to having to choose a high-paying specialty or an oversaturated specialty. And certainly, I think even on a personal level, a lot of these students express that it's affecting them structurally, but also just, as you can imagine, not having to deal with $400,000 of debt at age 30 is a huge source of relief for a lot of them. A lot of them talked about how they previously, you know, every purchase they made, even down to what to eat for the day, they thought about that $400,000. And now they have a lot more space to kind of breathe.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I mean, there's definitely been a push in recent years to try to win a free college education for young people. That was a part of some of the Bernie Sanders presidential campaigns. We haven't seen that happen, but I mean, I think we're seeing a glimpse here of what could happen if we freed students up from these crippling debts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it really goes to, you know, healthcare reform would require a huge overhaul, which I think would start even at the medical school level, to encourage students to be able to go and to be able to actually come back to the communities that they come from, as opposed to having to kind of continuously chase money.
Become plastic surgeons doing nose jobs for the rich.
Exactly. Yeah. Dr. Miami's.
So many of the students in your piece, I remember that's really what stuck with me, is that they said, now I can study what I want to study.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, exactly. It's really beautiful to kind of see, like, knowledge be their primary concern now, as opposed to kind of, you know, what they're going to do once right. This is all over. Yeah.
And serving other people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your coverage in this issue, both of that incredible development up in the Bronx and the fierce struggle in central Brooklyn to save a hospital. Ariana Orozco, thank you again for being on WBAI with us tonight. We look forward to you joining us more in the future.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back with more after this short break. that was...
The First Gymno Petty by Yusuf Lateef.
Right on. Thank you, Amba. This is John Tarleton, your co-host, along with our other co-host, Amba Gagarian. You're listening to the Independent News Hour on WBAI 99.5 FM. And before we move on to our third and final segment, which we're going to have a really interesting conversation coming up. But first of all, I want to encourage everybody who's listening, please call 212-209-2950. Help keep this radio station on the air. This is a listener-sponsored community radio station. You know, it's not National Pentagon Radio or National Petroleum Radio. It's WBAI community sponsored radio. 212-209-2950, or go to give number 2wbai.org. One of the very best ways you can support this station is to become a WBAI buddy for as little as $10 a month. And that recurring monthly donation gives the station a certain amount of sort of financial stability from one month to the next when we know that have that support coming in. We do a similar program at the Independent, and I can tell you we certainly treasure the support of our monthly sustainers. So if you can become a WBAI buddy today, 212-209-2950.
I mean, I think about the amount of money that we spend each month, like how we spend $10 in a month, and if you think that's worth, you know, what we're offering here on the only radio station that is, you know, providing independent news on the New York City dial, then I think that you should do it. And I would like to appeal specifically today to the other young people out there. We need you. We need us. You know, there's a lot of old hardcore supporters of like leftist media institutions within New York City, and they can't be the only ones, you know, donating because we're, you know, need to be sort of revitalized by the youth and new viewers and people who still value radio and newspapers and things like this, methods of communication that are, you know, accessible to anybody and really empower free speech. So please, you know, if you're out there and you have a little bit more money in your pockets than you did 10 years ago when you first started listening to independent radio, now is the time to, you know, put your big kid shoes on and give, start donating. So please, you could do that by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or go online, pull out the plastic, and go to give the number 2wbai.org. That's give numeral 2wbai.org. Of course, if you can do it monthly, that's the best way to do it. And if you can do it in the name of the Independent News Hour, that's a way that we can know that you value what we're putting out here each week.
Right. And when you give to support WBAI, you're not only supporting the Independent News Hour. I mean, we have some great programming coming up with the rest of tonight on WBAI. We have the half-hour edition of Democracy Now! From 6 to 6:30, Interpersonal Update with Harriet Fraud at 6:30 to 7. And we have Science, Health, and Healing from 7 to 8 p.m., Out FM from 8 to 9 p.m., Cat Radio Cafe from 9 to 10 p.m., and The Sweet Spot from 10 p.m. Till midnight. You can see this really rich mixture of news and public affairs show, music shows, cultural shows, all here on WBAI, a really unique radio station on the radio dial here in New York, with our transmitter at Times Square beaming about 90 miles in all directions, out to Long Island, up the Hudson Valley, across New Jersey. Your support keeps that antenna and that transmitter humming along at Times Square, helps keep this station running on a very shoestring budget. Every dollar goes a long ways. One more time, 212-209-2950. Given the name of the Independent News Hour, you can also go to give number 2wbai.org, pull out the plastic, become that WBAI buddy for $10, $15, $20 a month. We'll love you so much for it. And, please think about how you can support this station and all that it does for you.
Absolutely. Thank you, John. And so we are going to turn here to our third and final segment of the evening. We're really excited to be speaking with Naib Man of WAWG, the Writers Against the War in Gaza. which is a group that formed at the end of October. It's a group of media and culture workers that came together to speak out against Israel's genocide on Gaza. And it's a project, I think that's worth noting, that was modeled on the American Writers Against the Vietnam War. So, you know, this is a continuum of movement and a continuum of fighting against imperialism and toward Palestinian freedom and the freedom of other occupied peoples. And this group has staged several high visibility direct actions, probably how you've heard of them if you have, of WAWOG, since its founding. Most recently, in a four-pronged action on March 14th, targeted specifically at the New York Times for manufacturing consent for the U.S.-Israeli war machine, specifically, you know, what's going on in Gaza. And it was, again, a four-pronged action. First, the Times morning routes for the paper couldn't be executed as planned because activists blockaded the distribution trucks from leaving the printer for at least 3 hours, the wee hours of the morning. Then at 9 a.m., as various employees started arriving to the New York Times building in Midtown Manhattan for their annual State of the Times address, they were blocked and harangued by at least 200, probably more like 300 pro-Palestine protesters who sat in at three locations with over 120 arrests. And then at that same time, scores of what we called newsboys were distributing a mock paper called The New York War Crimes. It's now in its sixth issue that's put together by WAWOG and others. They were distributing that newspaper, over 8,000 copies in 100 locations across the city, and also a website, which is www.newyorkwarcrimes.com. was launched, and that website brings together contemporary Palestinian writing as well as historic examples of why the New York Times supports the U.S. war machine over and over and over again. And so now I'd like to welcome WAWOG member Naib Nian onto the show, onto WBAI, to talk about all of this, you know, and how us media workers and culture workers are responding to the genocide. So hi, Naib. It's so good to be here with you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And maybe I should state for clarity's sake that I'm somewhat involved in this whole project, and I'm proud to say so. So let's talk first about why we're pinpointing the Times. Obviously, they're not the only, you know, mainstream media outlet that is manufacturing consent for war.
Yeah, I mean, our argument is very clear. The Times has blood on its hands. It's a weapon in the arsenal of America's war machine. They manufacture consent for genocide, for war, for foreign intervention. We can get into what that looks like, what that has looked like over the past 6 months in the current conflict in Gaza, as well as over the past several decades. But you're right. I mean, the Times is not the only ones who are doing this. This is the case across all of American media. The thing about the Times, though, is that they do this under the guise of liberalism and objectivity. The Times doesn't have the reputation of right-wing propaganda. It operates as this authority. They like to call themselves the paper of record.
Mm-hmm.
It's the paper that this country's power brokers wake up to in the morning.
Absolutely.
It's the mouthpiece for those same people. So, you know, our demand is also clear. We need to boycott, divest, and unsubscribe from the Times. That means not reading the paper, not playing their games, not cooking their recipes, divesting from this idea that they're these arbiters of quality journalism.
And quality life, elite life.
Totally, yeah. I mean, it's the paper of those people who are running this country, running this city. And if you're still subscribing, unsubscribe, and you can channel those donations towards this radio station or towards material support for folks who are in Gaza right now.
Absolutely right. So that's the call. You know, that's the ask of these organizers, is to boycott, divest, and unsubscribe from the New York Times. And, you know, some people are like, well, how am I going to learn about the world if I don't subscribe to the New York Times? And, you know, I...
Read the Independent.
Read the Independent. Listen to WBAI. But I test you. Like, a lot of... Well, first of all, when it's local coverage, even in New York City, but especially in other places, you know, there's other local papers like that have covered the issues that the Times are getting to before that. So maybe, like, look into local news, look into other sources, especially if it's in the Middle East. You know, a lot of Middle Eastern sites, you translate their coverage. So consider other perspectives. And if you need to, like, hop on someone's Time subscription every once in a while, it's okay. We won't kill you. You can pool your subscriptions. But if 10 of your friends have subscriptions, cut that down to one. Take your money away from them and show them that you care, that they're... Anyway, I'll get off my high horse. So let's talk more about let's talk more about the website that I was talking about, www.newyorkwarcrimes.com. What the different sections are there? We offer a history section, a data section, these close reads of New York Times articles, and then, you know, coverage from Palestinian writers. But kind of tell us about how it's a good weapon against the Times.
Totally, yeah. The website is this comprehensive analysis of the New York Times and what journalism since October 7th and before has looked like. We've looked at coverage since October 7th with these close line-by-line readings of their articles. And, you know, the Times has been framing this narrative of inexplicable terrorism by Hamas with no historical context, that Israel is responding to proportionally, that the U.S. is this cautious ally that's urging restraint. You know, they're framing this idea that the attacks that we're seeing on hospitals and schools are regrettable but necessary. I mean, it's really criminal stuff. They're ignoring stories of the dead, wounded, and kidnapped Palestinians, or they lace them with this victim blaming that those victims were supporters of Hamas. There's these, you know, just completely fabricated stories about sexual violence being conducted by Hamas. That have been discredited many times. We did deep data analysis, sort of scraping all of the articles that have been published since October 7th, and found that the Times reported on anti-Semitism 5 times more than Islamophobia, despite, you know, substantial rise in Islamophobia across the country. Israelis and Americans were quoted far more than Palestinians, both official and unofficial sources. And meanwhile, the death toll in Gaza has climbed to more than 25 times that in Israel. So there's these deep disparities in how they're reporting on the issue. But it doesn't start on October 7th, right? History doesn't start on October 7th. There's a long history of the Times' shoddy reporting and falsehoods that they've used to substantiate claims that led us to war in Iraq, to the disaster in Libya, to regime changes in Latin America. This is something that the Times has been doing for a long time. So, and then we also published the New York War Crimes paper, and that, you know, while the website is this analysis of the New York Times and what they've been doing, the paper is really printing what the Times refuses to print, which is writings from Palestine, voices of Palestinian prisoners, the names of martyrs. You know, we're offering something that American news media and the Times refuses to allow the public to see.
And you were able to get that newspaper into, like, a lot of bodegas. I mean, a lot of the bodega owners in this city are Yemeni or otherwise Arab. Can you talk about that, like how you're able to have this sort of grassroots reach?
Yeah. We recruited hundreds of folks to go across, I think, 4 of the city's 5 bureaus, placing them in bodegas in various sites. I think some people put them in mosques. So, you know, there's
lots of public institutions, too, libraries, schools, places like this.
Newsstands across the city. I mean, it's a local effort. We're reaching people where they are. And I think, you know, people are thirsty and hungry for real news.
And that's what I wanted to talk about now, which is that people are thirsty and that people are acting. You know, one thing, too, on the website that I want to mention really briefly is a style guide that, you know, tells, you know, either if you're a reader, you know, wakes you up to some of the coded language that we've been reading that is dehumanizing and just sometimes not accurate. But also for writers, right? Access to, like, how can we, like, write in ways that, you know, are humanizing, that are truth-telling? But that took a lot of work on a lot of different people's parts to put the data analysis, style guide, distribution, all this stuff. People are being driven to committed action in a way that we haven't seen in a while. And of course, it's really difficult that this is happening because there's a genocide happening. It makes the factor for analysis that's really big, right? Talk a little bit about that, about how we've seen people in New York City, but also around the world, doing this sort of committed action. Now we're, you know, it's been since October, we're 6 months in, and people are still being very active.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing folks continue to mobilize. Momentum is sustaining. We're not going anywhere. People are still in the streets. And, you know, in fact, we're getting more organized. We're escalating. You're seeing actions at cultural institutions, at media institutions. You're seeing people organize within their sectors. I think that that's incredibly important. We have to make sure that wherever we are, whatever work that we're doing is, you know, is a tool, is a weapon resisting, this war that America is waging. You know, here in America, we're not just complicit. This is America's war on Palestine as much as it is Israel's. And it's our responsibility to continue resisting here.
Right. And can you just maybe delve in a little further into how we have media outlets like The Times, but also CNN, MSNBC, et cetera, that are associated sort of more with the Democratic Party. These are not MAGA outlets. These are not raving Fox News outlets that sort of foreground a concern about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, but still support the war and sort of reflect the Biden administration line in that way of wanting to deliver humanitarian aid to the same people that are being bombed with American weapons.
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of creating this illusion, I think, that we have in this country of diverse opinions, diverse political opinions. What we're seeing across the board is the same thing, right? Whether it's bombs that are being dropped or bombs that are being dropped with some, like, food attached to them. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, across all of these different news outlets, you're seeing them toe the line of the American government, whether we have a Republican in office or a Democrat. Support for Israel is, you know, there's no red line, as they've said over and over again. And whether they publish some articles that publish the faces of Palestinians who have died at the same time, you know, the majority of reporting is just, you know, it's basically word for word what we're hearing from Israeli officials, just again the mouthpiece of the American government and the mouthpiece of the IDF.
And it's like would you agree that it's diminishing? I mean, you don't see it as much in the news. There's been this terrible out of the news I've read, I think some of the most horrendous, you know, things that have happened since the genocide started, you know, in October, going on in Al-Shifa Hospital in the north of Gaza, which is receiving no humanitarian aid. Do you feel like we're not hearing as much about it? And then at all being covered?
And there's also this phenomena of the passive voice in these headlines, you know, yeah. Like, bomb blast kills 73 in refugee camp.
When they do come.
U.S. demands, you know, investigation. Like, it's not the bomb didn't kill people. Israel dropped the bomb on people. You know, it's just that whole passive voice that do almost anything to avoid stating responsible for the violence.
Yeah, I mean, you see them bending over backwards so hard in these headlines. I mean, it's like, bullet was attracted to person that went through them. And it's just ridiculous. And truly, Amba, as you were saying, like, the news gets worse and worse every day. I wake up and I see what's happening, and it's hard to believe. And as you're saying, we're not really seeing as much reporting about it. I mean, what we're seeing out of northern Gaza is pure horror. You know, aid reached for the first time in months, and the response was a raid on Al-Shifa Hospital, the kidnapping of journalists. And, you know, whatever reporting we have seen has called this an attack on Hamas, when actually it was the Gazan official responsible for distributing that food aid that the IOF murdered.
Yeah.
And so it's like a clear operation of punishing people for distributing aid and enforcing this famine.
Right. And I heard about how, too, more in detail, people had begun to organize themselves, like the men in the area and different aid workers in the area had begun to organize themselves to distribute the aid, and they, like, were attacking that human infrastructure. But in our last, we have, like, 1 minute here. And, you know, I was going to ask you about the Ramadan ceasefire resolution, but everybody knows about that. So I want to quickly touch on how in this Screams Without Words, How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence, this article that the New York Times, you know, came out with saying that at the beginning of the year, saying that Hamas used sexual violence in a systematized way has been very disproven in many regards. You know, again, we're not saying that rape is not used in war, but it's very, very poor reporting on the Times part, as called out by so many other news agencies. You know, they just added this little note, an update note, in that article yesterday, saying newly released video viewed by the Times showed the bodies of two teenage girls in Kibbutz Be'eri were fully clothed, not unclothed, like they claim at the beginning of the article, and that this undercuts this account from the Israeli military paramedic, who was one of their main sources. You know, your comment on that in our last 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, this piece of journalism was just, it's a surreal piece of reporting. I mean, from who they hired to report the story, these people with no reporting background, to the sort of like constant holes that we're starting to see in the reporting, like the three main victims that they mentioned in the piece. One of them, the family, has denied the claims that the New York Times article made. The other two, as you're saying, this evidence just came out that, you know, the kibbutz itself is saying that they weren't victims of sexual assault. This video showed that they probably weren't victims of sexual assault. And the Times refuses to retract the story. They refuse to sort of take accountability for the fact of the shoddy reporting. And they're committing to sort of manufacturing this narrative despite evidence against it constantly.
Right. As John said, John and I were talking earlier, he was like, they could have come out with an article, but it's just not even a footnote. It's just in brackets.
Yeah, can't count on integrity from the Times when the chips are really on the table.
So our time is wrapping up here, but thank you so much, Naib Mian, for joining us from Writers Against the War in Gaza. That ask is to boycott, divest, unsubscribe. And thanks for listening to the Independent News Hour here on WBAI 99.5 FM. We will be hearing Abaddon by Wyed Bouhassoun. Sorry, I am Amba Gregorian with my co-host John Tarleton and joined by our great board operator, Reggie Johnson.